It's Philip's third lecture in the series called Making Good, the Challenge of Robustly Demanding Values, and the lecture is entitled Virtues, Laws and Consequentialism. And I should say that it's been my experience now over 7 years that the curve of attendance for every UHERO lecture series goes exponentially down till the third one. There's a sort of scattering of people. So this is an enormous audience on a sunny day with the March Ascend talking as well. And so I think that's a testimony to how interested people are.
Thank you very much. Okay, so everybody has a handout, given the structure of what I'm going to try to cover. I think I'm going to be very unpopular today because I sort of feel like it's a confession these days. I'm a consequentialist, you know. I mean, there are consequentialists. Actually, there are much more radical consequentialists in this particular audience, as it happens. But there are a few concentrations of consequentialists in the world. Oxford is one. Princeton, I guess, is one. And there are a few places in Australia. But apart from that, we're regarded really as a slightly crude breed, really. But I'm a very sophisticated consequentialist. and I hope even perhaps a congenial one to the many non-consequentialists in the audience. Okay, so let me just begin by looking at what I see as the lessons or the implications. Yes, I guess calling them lessons suggests that definitely you've got to accept them. They're certainly implications of the stuff that I've defended in the last two lectures. So the first one is clearly that there are some goods. The goods which we rely on are virtues to deliver, so to speak, to produce. There are some goods, they're associated with incentive-independent goodwill, as in the good I enjoy when someone is a friend of mine, and so is goodwill towards me in the way of friendship, in a way that's relatively independent of incentive, so you'd expect the care of that friend to be more or less resilient, he/she being attached to me over various changes in those incentives, even when it was tougher or less convenient to deliver the care to me. So that sort of good, that incentive-independent good, and of course it's also associated not just with friendship, a bilateral relationship like that, but also with the honesty of someone, with the justice of someone, with the fact that they, for example, in the honesty case, they can be relied upon to tell the truth across incentives over those sorts of variations. These goods which we produce for one another, these incentive-independent goodwill goods, so to speak, the first lesson really can be summed up in what I call a fallacy here, an actuarial fallacy, which is that with these goods, as I said, virtue produces them, and only virtue produces them. You've got to be of that sort of someone, your friend's got to be, the person, the honest person's got to be, of that robust goodwill towards those he or she deals with in order for his or her companions to enjoy that good, so to speak, at their hands. But the thing is, in order for others to enjoy that good at their hands, they must forswear what I call here, deliberative beneficence. Now, I mean by deliberative beneficence the sort of attitude that someone might adopt when dealing with other people or dealing with any decision, of always considering all the possible relevant considerations. Basically, I mean, I'm thinking of someone who's beneficent, someone who wants to do good, not someone who's self-seeking. And the deliberatively beneficent person is someone who will think in every occasion about all the pros, all the cons, how the world might be in the wake of their action, and will always choose that action which, having done the sums, as it were, looks to be the optimistic action, the action that will produce the most good. Now, I guess this isn't big news, really, because lots of people have hammered this from different angles in the past. I think of this as an actuarial fallacy. It's the fallacy of thinking that by being a sort of moral actuary, you know, the actuary is someone who does all the costs and all the benefits over a long period, puts in the probabilities, does the sums, gets the conclusion, and that's it. Now, the fallacy is the idea that by being a moral actuary, by, as you move from situation to situation, always being prepared, however quickly, however on the back of an envelope or whatever, to do the sums, you know, to see what is really for the best. It really is a sort of fallacy, it seems to me, that such a person is likely to produce, actually is likely to be optimistic, is likely to produce the most good, because that person will be systematically undermining, jeopardizing the possibility of producing those goods associated just with being virtuous. So, for example, you know, silly but maybe vivid illustration, the sort of friend, I think I've said this in previous discussions, like you ask him or her if they'll help you to move an apartment, if they'll help you to do any, if they'll come around and, you know, help with your sick spouse or children or whatever, the sort of friend who says, yeah, okay, good question, let me just think about it, and then does, you know, the quick actuarial calculation of what's for the best overall, what they might do with their time otherwise, whether this is actually the best investment of their resources. From the point of view of producing good, that sort of person cannot be a friend. And if they do you the turn, it's because you are fortunate enough to fall on the trajectory of their beneficence, so to speak. You're fortunate enough to be at the position, at the locus, where, as it turns out, from their point of view, they can best invest their optimific resources. Is that my phone that's ringing? I hope it's not. Forgive me if it was. Ask not for whom the phone. Yeah, okay. So that's a sort of actuarial fallacy, and that's a direct result, I think, of seeing that virtues produce, in their own right and indispensably, these particular sorts of goods, these robustly demanding goods, that are entrenched by the goodwill of the other person. Okay. And the second sort of fallacy is, if you go along with the argument of the second lecture, there are certain goods, in particular, the goods I'm interested in are the goods that often figure under the name of freedom. There are certain goods that we collectively can produce for us individually as members of a community by virtue of the laws that we have in place. Laws that, for example, cement in the resources available to us. Laws that establish what can be done, what can't be done. Laws that, in particular, are not imposed by the will of a benevolent despot or anything. Laws that are in some way subject to our equal control. And we, as the argument went, we by collectively, publicly, by resort to that sort of arrangement, can produce for each one of us that great good of status freedom, which, you know, in the traditional language is the good of being able to look others in the eye without fear and without deference. The good in particular of not having to defer a fear, because it's a matter of common knowledge that you exist within a protected zone, a zone where the laws, by giving you, empowering you and protecting you, and the laws which saturate the attitudes, to take up points the various people made in the discussion of the last day, saturate the attitudes of the whole community. We, for each one of us, produce that extraordinarily important good of freedom in the first place, protection, empowerment against interference in this domain that's allotted to each person equally, the domain of choice, and then dignity insofar as that's a matter of common knowledge, and respect insofar as people do indeed internalize those attitudes. So you really have, I mean, that's almost the greatest good, you know, I think, that we can do for individual human beings, is to provide that that sort of status, freedom, dignity, and respect. And now, it's an agential fallacy to think that we individually could do that for others just by being really nice to them, by being really good-willed. And to draw a line under that and to make it vivid, think about what I think of as an example of the agential fallacy is that sort of, I suppose it's the libertarian line that says, look, all this stuff about the laws providing for example, basic welfare, for security, for access to the courts, I mean, this is just a horrible imposition of the government on our backs and so on. And it's much better if we go back to, for example, you might think of it as a philanthropic Victorian tradition whereby, you know, the doctor, who was always pretty well off, never refused treatment to a poor patient. You know, gave pro bono, as we call it, treatment to someone who was in need, or the lawyer, who again, of course, would give pro bono service to someone who wasn't able to pay for the service. But just think about it. Someone who has to, as it were, depend in that way on the goodwill of the benevolent doctor or lawyer or whatever it may be, our soup kitchen, you know, our church, our donor of that kind, someone who has to depend on that, the contingency, the fortuity of having such very good people. There's no criticism here at all involved with the individuals, but someone who has to depend on that as distinct from having these things as of right, as of legal right, as of legally effective right, supported by the deep running attitudes and so on of the community. Someone who is to depend on that sort of goodwill does not enjoy the sort of freedom I'm talking about, and does not enjoy the dignity that goes with that freedom or the respect the status of respect that goes with that freedom when it's a matter of knowledge that they have it as of right. So I would say that it's awfully easy in thinking about ethics and thinking about morality to drift into the fallacy of thinking that it's just doing good that morality is all about. Morality is all about, it's about being good as well. That's as against the actuarial fallacy. But it's also about establishing a good community, a good law. Because as I was arguing in the two last lectures, virtue does more for the good than just prompt us to do good or prime us in our perceptions of what is good. And the law does more for the good than just prompt us to comply and behave well, or than just prime us in the sense of signalling what it is good that we should do. It actually, as we're mainlined, establishes these goods in our society. So these goods, you might say, as I put it here, the goods of freedom in the law case and the various goods of incentive independent goodwill. Freedom, of course, is goodwill independent, non-interference, non-frustration. That's to say, enjoying a domain of choice and a status vis-a-vis others that is not dependent on the goodwill of others. That's even others that are indeed very benevolent, that is free of that, that's created for each by the laws that all subscribe to and in one way or another all support. Those goods, they come about as an essential byproduct. See, they're a byproduct of people being virtuous in the first set of cases, and they're a byproduct of the laws being appropriate laws in the second. And it's just doing good is not going to be the be-all and end-all of ethics, as it were. Now, the question I want to raise today is, what is the significance of recognising these, if you agree with me that they exist, these robustly demanding goods, whether entrenched by virtue or entrenched externally by law, what's the significance for consequentialism of recognising these? Okay, so I'm going to defend two theses, and then because I sort of... I think because of the shortage of time and the feeling I couldn't be really persuasive, I'm going to, rather than defend a third thesis, I'm going to raise a question, which is a challenge for those of you who are of a non-consequentialist slant of mind. So the first thesis I'm going to defend is that, of course, these goods are perfectly consistent, recognize them with being a consequentialist. The second one is that actually once you recognize them as a consequentialist, you think they're part of the good to be promoted in the world, then your consequentialism, and of course some may welcome, some may not welcome this lesson, but your consequentialism becomes less revisionary of what we call common sense morality, more easily equilibrated in Rawls's phrase with our reflective judgments as to what we should do. The question is, are they actually inconsistent with non-consequentialism? Can non-consequentialism really embrace what I've been saying about these goods and say, yes, you know, these are really important and they're really supporting me in my non-consequentialism? My feeling, but I'm putting this as a question for today's purposes anyhow, is that actually non-consequentialism is going to create a problem for really taking these goods seriously. Okay, so on to the first one then, about the recognition, as I put here, robustly demanding goods is consistent with consequentialism. Well, actually, this I can do fairly quickly, I think, because we've talked about it in various ways up to now. So consequentialism holds that the right option in any choice is basically determined by which option, how the options compare in the promotion of neutral good. Now, by neutral or agent-neutral good, as they sometimes call it, I mean the sort of good that's not identified indexically, like my welfare. Well, if you talk about my welfare, in my mouth it means one thing, in somebody else's mouth it means another, and so on. It's indexical. It's actually a schema for identifying a good. Philip Pettit's good, Victoria McGeer's good, Bennett Foddy's good. It's a different thing in each case. But a neutral good is good that's identified non-indexically. That's the basic feature of neutral good. And amongst neutral goods, of course, some goods are purely particular, like the welfare of Great Britain is a particular good. The welfare of Philip Pett is a particular but neutrally identified good. Universal neutrally identified good will be the good which isn't associated with a particular person or place or country. So I'm going to assume what consequentialism says is that the right option in any choice is really a function of how the options compare in the generation of universal neutral good, or goods, if you like. Because, of course, it's an open question as to how many goods there are and how they compare, or whether they can be summed up, or whether they can be weighted with one another in a complex package. That's all to the side. That's all another issue and for another day. Okay, so if consequentialism holds that the right option, any choice, is that which, I put it here, promotes the neutral good. I put question mark after promotes because there are different accounts of what promotes means. For the record, I tend to take it to mean, and this is sort of technical, we needn't bother going into it, maximize expected good, but others will mean actually maximize the good as a matter of fact. I'm just going to put that aside, that issue. It's orthogonal to the questions that we'll be discussing. Now, I think it's a really interesting feature of the discussion of consequentialism over the last 200 years, that there's been a tendency among consequentialists and non-consequentialists, among consequentialists and amongst their critics, to sort of limit the goods that can be relevant in a consequentialist determination or criterion of what it's right to choose in any choice. So the most obvious sort of limitation or narrowing on the goods that might be thought to be relevant is the one associated with the canonical form of consequentialism, I say, which is hedonic utilitarianism, right? So according to hedonic utilitarianism, according to this version of consequentialism, the only goods that are relevant are what you might call experiential goods. They're goods such that, and I mentioned in the first lecture, Nozick's experience machine, they're goods such that you can enjoy them in the real world, like, for example, enjoy power in the real world, real power. But if you're looking at power as just for the experiential aspect of power, you could just as well enjoy it on the experience machine. The experience machine, you know, is like a simulation machine. It's like, pilots, they put in these simulation devices like on a plane, and it's exactly with them as if they were on a plane, and that's how they can learn. In the experience machine, it's exactly with you as if you had power or celebrity or achievement or whatever. Now, the first narrowing of consequentialism is that it's only concerned with experiential goods or subjective goods, goods of the kind that you can get as well in the experience machine as in reality. Now, clearly, that's an unnecessary. We've all learned that that's an unnecessary restriction. In fact, even many versions of utilitarianism itself, the preference satisfaction versions of utilitarianism, are not experiential, and certainly most other consequentialisms are not experiential. They don't just think that the good boils down to experiential goods. They include goods that are, as I put it here, factively demanding. They demand that things are thus and so in the world. So if anti-power, to take what I was talking about the last day, is a good, it demands that there really are constraints on that other person in respect of how they can treat you. It's not enough to have just the experiential counterpart of anti-power. You know, this feeling, feeling you're in this great world, everybody lets you make your choices, and so on, but it's actually all illusion, and says it's all an experience. I don't want to hammer that point, okay? That's sort of fairly clear. But a second limitation on the goods the consequentialists are, so to speak, allowed by their critics, or even they themselves sometimes aspire to recognize, is to say, well, it's only, well, you might call them now simply experiential, presentist goods. That's to say, goods that make no demands on how the past was or how the future will be. So, for example, to enjoy, a good career, you can't enjoy it at a given moment. Things must have been thus and so in the past, presumably, and actually things must be thus and so in the future as well. It's a temporally or diachronically demanding good, right? Now, again, it seems to me there's no reason to restrict consequentialism to presentist goods, although there is a tendency in the literature to do that. I once invented the word, I actually rather liked it, but it didn't seem to take off. Maybe there weren't many of them around, of subsequentialism. You know, it was the theory that as a consequentialist, you could only want the maximization of goods such that it didn't matter how the past was, those goods would still be there to be maximized. Now, G. Moore taught us that we shouldn't focus just on experiential goods. Do you remember chapter 3 of Principia Ethica, where he talks about the ideals of friendship, for example, and how the right is determined by what actual, factively demanding good it produces? And many others have taught us that equally you can be a consequentialist and the goods you're concerned with can be temporally or diachronically demanding. So, for example, Nozick, I think, did a service in pointing out that you could be a consequentialist who thought that the thing to maximise was the satisfaction of people's rights. Okay, now, what someone's rights are presumably depends on how things were in the past. So if someone has a right to this piece of physical stuff, it's because they bought it in the past, right? So if you think that for a whole range of rights, you should organise things or organise your life so that the satisfaction of those rights is maximised, then you're focusing on goods that are temporally or diachronically demanding. Or, I mean, with John Braithwaite back in about 1990, I published a book called Not Just Desserts, and we argued there, and I think I was utterly persuaded by the argument, actually. We argued there that that many people who thought of themselves as non-consequentialist or retributivist in criminal justice were actually a strange species of consequentialist. I mean, a perfectly logically consistent species of consequentialist, who, for example, thought that the criminal justice system should be designed so that just deserts, right, were satisfied at the highest level possible. That's a consequentialist theory. And, of course, just deserts, because someone gets their just deserts, which is, I mean, in the sense of that that's not a very pleasant thing to get, meaning criminal retribution. Whether they get just deserts or not depends on how the past was, whether they really did commit the crime. So, anyhow, these are just two analogies. We've learned that consequentialism is not confined to experiential goods and is not confined to presentist goods. And what I've been arguing, really, is on a third dimension, that neither should it be confined, and that's what I'm now maintaining, neither should it be confined to actualist goods, to goods that only make demands on how the actual world is, rather than making demands also on how things are under various eventualities, that's to say, on how things are in various non-actual worlds. Actualistic consequentialism, a consequentialism that would say, look, the only good you'd be concerned with should be goods that are, you know, like here and now, you just have them in the actual world, and you could have them in the actual world regardless of how things were under other eventualities. So, for example, you can have fun in the actual world, and you can have as much fun as you like, independently of what happens under other eventualities. Actually, you're having a lot of fun. You know, it doesn't require that things would have happened, doesn't so had such and such an eventuality transpired, and so on. It doesn't require that. You're enjoying fun. Or, for example, you're enjoying preference satisfaction. You know, the preferences you actually have are actually satisfied. That's a real good, and it's a naturalist good. It's a good that doesn't require anything about, well, what would have happened had you preferred something else. No, it doesn't matter what would have happened had you preferred something. Here and now, you can enjoy preference satisfaction. So an actualistic consequentialism, what it would do is force us to restrict the goods that are relevant to determining right choices to goods of that actualist kind. So, for example, I said that friendship is a non-actualist good. It's a robustly demanding good because you enjoy friendship only if not only you get actual care, but you would get care under various eventualities, similarly for love and so on. But care is an actualist good. All you need, the person is actually looking after you, you know, answering your requests or whatever it might be, you know, really making life sort of cozy for you. For example, an actualist consequentialist would say, well, you can be concerned about how much truth-telling goes on in the world, perhaps, and that might be a relevant thing to try to maximise or promote, but they would have no truck with trying to promote honesty, because that's a non-actualist good. To be an honest person, to have someone be honest in dealing with you, is for them to tell you the truth actually, but it's also for them to be such that they will tell the truth even if it's less convenient and even if you're less charming under those eventualities. So it's a non-actualist good, a robustly demanding good. Now, there's no reason whatsoever that I can see to restrict consequentialism to these actualist goods. And what I'm going to want, so I'm just arguing that now these goods are consistent with consequentialism. I'll be going on to argue something richer in just a moment. Or to take in the freedom case is actually particularly important. Because someone might say, well, now look, you're interested in promoting freedom in the world. Okay, you want the laws that will promote freedom, the measures, the rules, etc., that will promote freedom. Well, why worry about all this sort of, you know, stuff that would happen under various arrangements? Why not just be concerned with maximizing non-interference? Actually, that's what they call it, but they shouldn't, because Berlin is taken as the, you know, the catechism, as it were, on what non-interference means. And for him, it's a robustly demanding good, as we saw. To enjoy non-interference is to enjoy, actually, non-frustration. But also to be in a position where you would enjoy non-frustration had you chose other than what you actually chose. So really, they should say non-frustration, which is to say preference satisfaction. And, of course, that's the dominant position in economics. Someone like Amartya Sen, who at this moment is lecturing elsewhere, I understand, at the university. I mean, Amartya, one of his big sort of contributions was back in the 70s, and so was to keep hammering the point that just by ensuring preference satisfaction, you did not deliver freedom. Now, he actually thought of freedom in a Berlinian way, that it required not just that your actual choice be unopposed, but that the counterfactual choice, what you might have chosen but didn't, should also be unopposed. But very interestingly, I recommend it to all of you. Christian List published a paper in 2004 and again an updated version of it in 2006, which showed that, of course, this is a very continual result from my point of view, that actually Sen's formal results committed him to a Republican notion of freedom, a notion under which, in order to enjoy freedom, it's not just the case that you enjoy non-frustration in the case of choosing X, but also in the case of choosing Y. Apart from that, it also had to be the case that you would enjoy non-frustration even under variations in other people's wishes as to what you should do. Right? So that's a more robust demanding. In any case, I think Sen really brought out for us that freedom is this robustly demanding sort of good rather than a good just to do with the actual world. And I really want to emphasize this because some of the people I most admire, and as it happens, some among those who are most dear to me within the discipline, I think still make this mistake. I'm sorry to put it this way, but say Bob Gooden and Frank Jackson wrote a book called Fear of Free, an article called Fear of Freedom. I don't know whether you know it. It was in Philosophy and Public Affairs in 2007, I believe. There was an absolutely definitive rebuttal in Philosophy and Public Affairs, 2008, it was mine. He says modestly. But, I mean, it's very interesting what Frank and Bob do in that paper. They really have a very strong one problem. They use the word actualism in a different sense from me in that paper. Be warned. And actually, Frank had used the word actualism in yet another sense in his paper, some of you may know it, with Bob Pargeter on actualism and possibilism. Forget about those uses of the term. Just let it mean what it means, as I've been describing here. And what they really argue for is they say, if you're concerned about freedom, aren't you concerned about non-interference? Other people aren't getting it. And then shouldn't you design things so that you maximize expected non-interference? Just design things so that there's a minimum of non-interference going on. And of course, you know, you need only run the Berlin argument against that, because you can see that if you're in a world where there are differences of power, etc., etc., the best way of maximizing non-interference might be to get the weak always to choose that which the know the powerful would want them to choose, in other words, to self-censor their choices, or maybe to pay off the rich by giving them rewards, you know, for not interfering, to ingratiate them in that way. That might indeed maximize non-frustration. It might be the best way of ensuring that actually there's not much frustration going on of preference. But of course that would not ensure freedom, not by Berlin's account and not by the richer freedom as non-domination account. So it's really worth hammering this. And perhaps I'm over-hammering it, but so the thought's going to be then that if we're consequentialists, we can surely countenance these robustly demanding goods that are only available via virtue or via law, as well as the more actualist goods. It would be a sort of self-denying restriction, as I put it here, for thinking, oh, no, no, as consequentialists, we can only look at actualist goods. Why on earth might that be the case? I know of no reason, no good reason, why anyone might think it is. But there is a bad reason why someone might think it is. And it's an interesting bad reason, and I want to just draw attention to that before moving on to the second thesis. In some discussions of consequentialism, the point was made that what the consequentialist, the claim was made, that what the consequentialist is interested in is doing the things which have the best consequences in the sense of the best causally detachable consequences. I mean, there is a very ordinary use of the word consequence, under which a consequence of something is an effect that occurs later than the cause, for example, and indeed occurs as a causal consequence of what was done. And so some readings of consequentialism, for example, Fred Schick in a book in the 80s, insists that the consequences relevant must be causally detachable consequences. Actually, Bernard Williams, in his contribution to the book with Smart, himself rejects that. He thinks there's absolutely no reason why consequentialists shouldn't be concerned about not just the goods of the effects that happen downstream from the things they do, but shouldn't be concerned with the actual things they do. Those are events in the world too. So, for example, you know, when I hit Julian, I can regard the pain he'll have in 2 minutes' time, you know, strong as I am, and so on. And I can regard the damage that he'll have in 24 hours' time as bad consequences of that. But equally, just the assault itself, which isn't the consequence of the assault, it is the assault, that itself, you might think, is a very bad thing. You might just disvalue assault as such. That was the point Williams made. So consequences don't have to be causally detachable. But now it is worth noticing that the consequences that I've talked about, that I regard as the robustly demanding goods, they are not causally detachable from the effects, the virtues, and the laws that produce them. And that might come as a bit of a surprise. But when you think about it, there's nothing really very surprising about it. Let me give you an analogy, and then you can see how it might be possible. Actually, this analogy is from David Lewis, who admits exactly these sorts of points, but in a different context. Think about my immunity, as I hope I may have it, to at least some diseases, right? And now you think about what brings about that immunity in me? What's responsible for it? And what we've learned, of course, logically, it might be anything, including, you know, the angel that guards over me or something. But as a matter of fact, for most of us, what we've learned is that it's the antibodies that have been generated in my blood as a result of exposure to this particular bacterium in the past, right? That's what constitutes my immunity. Now, the antibodies is just one way in which the immunity might have come about. Logically, there are other ways which it might come about. The antibodies, as were, generate the immunity. But it's not as if you put the antibodies in place and then you've got to wait, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 hours and the immunity's in place. I mean, that's silly, right? Once the antibodies are there, the immunity is there. Right? And of course, that's not surprising because immunity itself is a sort of robustly demanding property, right? You're immune only if actually you don't get it, and neither would you get it if you're exposed to it or exposed in this way or that way or the other way, right? And the antibodies generate the immunity, but not in a causally detachable way. As we say, the immunity consists in, is constituted by, the antibodies. Now, there are many philosophical themes you might ring around this topic, but I'm not going to explore them. They might come up in discussion. But I want to say that, in a similar way, if the laws are in place which genuinely provide me, as a matter of common knowledge, anchored in the attitudes that saturate my fellows in my community, to go back to the theme that various of you were hammering yesterday, including Jeremy, for example. If the laws are in place that give me that protection as a matter of common knowledge, internalized in the attitudes of other people, then I've got status. You know, I've got the status of what used to be called a free man. Excuse the masculinism, a free person, right? Amongst others. But that status that comes to me, which is so important, isn't a causally detachable feature from the laws. It relates to them much like the immunity relates to the antibodies. It consists in the protective zone that the laws give me. And similarly, I would say the good that I enjoy at the hands of a friend who is goodwill towards me in an incentive-independent way, this good that I treasure of his or her incentive-independent goodwill towards me, a goodwill that remains a place as the incentives vary, this good that I enjoy is not causally detachable from their virtue. Just in the presence of their virtue, it's what constitutes my enjoyment of that particular good. So someone might think that no, consequentialists can't help themselves to these particular non-actualist, modally demanding goods because they're not causally detachable from the things that, as we say, produce them. That's just a mistake, because consequentialism doesn't have to focus only on causally detachable consequences. So, first thesis, if you're a consequentialist, you can have a perfectly good conscience, let me assure you, about it, about embracing these robustly demanding goods. Okay, now, so the second thesis I want to say is that if once you do recognize these as goods amongst the various goods that we human beings have produced for one another and for ourselves, both individually and collectively, once you recognize these goods as goods to be produced, once you think then that right choices are a function, at least in part, of how these goods are served as well as other goods are served, then consequentialism looks to be capable of being much less revisionary of common sense morality. Now, I'm going to argue this without arguing that, therefore, you know, common sense morality is dead right and we should go with this. I can see some of the audience who think this is a sad thing and may indeed, for that very reason, back off the robustly demanding goods, say they're not as important as I'm making them out to be. I'm not going to argue with people taking that view. I'm just going to say, if you endorse robustly demanding goods, which certainly there's no reason in being consequentialist not to do, but if you do and think that the right is a function and part of those goods, then your consequentialism is going to be less revisionary. So think about the view you're going to take if you're a consequentialist and you do countenance these goods. So you're going to think that my consequentialism, which tells me the choices I make should be a function of the goods I produce, I'm now going to become aware that, well, of course, the goods I produce are a function of the virtues I instantiate. So insofar as I can choose my virtues, and I can certainly choose to cultivate virtues, to maintain them, to succor them, you know, to make sure I read the right sort of, and I admire the right sort of people, I'm going to think, gee, it's important that, showing you some measure, that I have these virtues, that I choose these right virtues. And it's going to be important for us as a collectivity, and so for me as a citizen, that I argue that we do this, that we establish the right laws in our society, because they, just by their existence, are going to be responsible for so much of the important goods, by this account, in our lives. And, of course, I'm also going to think that just by having my virtues in place, as it were, a certain realm of virtue, and just by having the laws in place, is still going to leave me a lot of discretion. Remember what Hobbes said when he said that, he defined it as liberty exists in the silence of the law, but certainly there's a lot of discretion. I mean, law and virtue together will still leave a lot of silence, so there'll be a lot of cases where you do have to choose just action by action. See, but being virtuous is going to force you in certain ways to, just without thinking, as it were, behave in a certain way. And similarly, the law, if you abide, is going to restrict you, but there'll still be a lot of discretion. But what you want is that individually you establish such virtues in yourself and you choose such actions and collectively such laws that overall this is for the best. Now, of course, straight away you recognize a problem which is well recognized in the literature, that these choices, the choice of virtues, the choice of laws, the choice of actions, they interact with one another. So, for example, if I decide, you know, being a friend to at least a certain number of my friends is a really important virtue. Then what I basically decide is that in treating these people across a whole range of circumstances, it's going to be, for me, not a matter for thought as to how I respond to their requests or their needs. It is going to be second nature for me that I respond to their requests or their needs by just fulfilling them. That's what it is to be a friend. That's what it is to have the virtue of friendship. That's what it is to be such that the good associated, this robustly demanding good on the part enjoyed by others, is going to be available to them. But of course, if in this way I, as we're lock into friendship, we'll come in a moment to how I might do that, if I lock into friendship in this way, then that's going to put immense constraints on choices over actions. It means for relevant actions, I'm not going to allow myself just think about all the relevant, not going to allow myself to be actuarial. Of course, in the realm of discretion, I may allow myself, the realm that's left open by virtues and laws being in place, I may allow myself discretion and actuarial discretion and really think about what, from the point of view of those actions, is for the best in the world. But just locking into certain virtues and indeed recognizing certain laws, assume for the moment to make it simple that I have no problem with the laws, that I think the laws are good and right, locking into those, recognizing that how much good is produced by their being in place, is going to put immense constraints on a much moral discretion, so to speak. I am left when it comes to deciding amongst actions. And of course, and this is a little bit abstract and almost mathematical, the best thing to do is to have a pattern, so to speak, of virtue, and a pattern of commitment to law, and a pattern of commitment to those actions where you do debate all the pros and the cons, that overall is for the best in terms of the goods that you recognise, which will include the robustly demanding goods, but also all the other goods that you think are important in human life. Okay, so suppose that, so I'm going to do this then, as I put it here, I commit to certain virtues. Maybe I think of honesty is really important, and I think about what demands it makes, and I get a conception of what honesty is, and how much honesty is important, and when it's important, and I sort of commit to that so that within the realm of what I think of as relevant circumstances, someone asks me, I'm just not even going to hesitate about telling the truth, even if it's inconvenient to me. I will just, you know, it'll be important to me that I'm an honest person. And of course, it'll be important in ensuring that other people enjoy my honesty, enjoy the robustly demanding good that corresponds to it. So I'm going to forswear actuarial deliberation in the cases where my friendship or the honesty I've committed to or the justice I've committed to or whatever, where it has preempted my decision. I'm just going to go, you might almost say I go on automatic pilot, you know. I just lock on, you know, put on the automatic pilot, the friend pilot, you know, the honesty pilot. And those modules just determine how I behave. I'm not there examining all the time pros and cons. And I only do that when those pilots don't take over, when the virtues aren't speaking for what I should do, the virtues that I've committed to. Now, of course, you might see me say, how could you possibly do this? I mean, isn't this like Derek Parfit's self-effacing consequentialism, you know, where you forswear all deliberation, you know, you the ultimate self-denial. You never allow yourself to question at all the pros and cons of what you're doing. And that, of course, would be a moral absurdity, it seems to me, to forswear to that extent, to abjure all control over what you do. But consistently with locking into these virtues, or indeed locking into abiding by the laws that you approve of, more or less unthinkingly, you can be open in the following respect to, on occasion, not going along with what they demand. Those will be the occasions where the model I like or the image I like, if the red lights go on, the alarms ring. It's pretty clear that this is a case where acting blindly on the virtue, acting blindly in accordance with the law, may actually not be for the good overall. So let's take an example. Well, the example of friendship, of course, I've used it before. Friends ask me various things, and if I'm a good friend, will more or less automatically deliver, just deliver because when I can do it, when best is useful for the person, and so on. But if the friend asks me to move a body, now, wow, the red lights really go on there, right? No surprise that they should go on there. And then when the red lights go on, I, so to speak, I put the virtue offline. I don't let it dictate what I do automatically. And I reflect on the situation and the costs and the benefits and so on. And I may say, well, wait a moment, mate, hang on. What's this thing about a body? I mean, explain, tell me more. And if I discover that there's been a criminal act or whatever, surely I'm perfectly right to say, I'm afraid not on this occasion. You know, this is somewhere where you can't expect any friend, and certainly not me, to be helping you. Or to take another example, I'm an honest person. I treasure what honesty produces. I recognize how important it is in consequentialist terms. But, you know, hey, this guy comes to me, and you'll recognize the example, and says, have you seen Smith? And it's clear he's got a gun. You know, this is America. He's got a gun in his pocket or whatever, and he's an enemy of Smith's, and you realize that Smith is in real danger. Now, what do you do? Well, in a case like that, the red lights go on. So while you're a consequentialist about the presence of the virtue in yourself and about the control you give over to that virtue, in a case like that where the red lights come on, it's pretty clear, it doesn't take much reflection, that telling a lie to this person is the right thing to do. The costs of telling the truth are much too high. So you tell a lie. That's the right thing to do. Now, you remember, of course, that's an example from Kant. And I'm happily giving it here because, as I see it, the consequentialist view, even taking account of virtues, is going to handle this very well. It's going to tell us how important virtue is. It's going to give us a means whereby we can give importance of that kind to virtue, the virtue of honesty, and yet it's going to explain how we need not be slaves to the virtue. Okay, and again, we commit to certain laws which indict various patterns of behavior that undermine freedom or dignity or respect, and we treat those laws as pretty sacred. We, if we're officials, do not flout them. If we're individual citizens, we generally do not flout them. But, of course, there may come the case where flouting them is the right thing to do. Again, it's the red lights will go on in such a case, or at least we rely on the red lights going on in such a case. That's what I would say a consequentialist will do. And treating the laws with great respect, recognizing the good in themselves that they produce, will just be open to the situational possibility that here is not the place to be law-abiding, are there? Actually, there's now, of course, a big issue about emergency situations, and are they situations in which the law should be suspended, right? Actually, the Romans thought about that a lot, as many of you will know. They had a situation of a dictatorship. Of course, it went to pot in the first century BC, but prior to that, it seems to work very well. It was an arrangement under which the Senate declared that there was a national emergency sufficient to establish a dictator. But the dictator was established, and that meant the laws were suspended in various ways. But they were suspended for only a very definite time, and they were suspended only in a certain respect, and the dictator was given a certain role which was different from that of the consuls or any existing authority. That might be a way of handling the red light scenarios that do arise for every society in many ways. So, for example, in this case, it's very interesting to think about the torture case. So a challenge that would be put reasonably to a consequentialist is the challenge of, well, are you as a consequentialist committed then to thinking that the laws which rightly make torture, however we define it, broadly speaking, utterly unthinkable? Are you committed to thinking, though, that in the emergency case, you know, the authorities, the red lights are on, someone may commit a terrible crime, that in this case, the authorities should indeed suspend those laws and be entitled to exercise torture against suspects? This is a difficult issue. And I'm standing in front of Jeremy Waldron, who's written extremely persuasively and influentially, I think, on this topic. And I just want to say the following, that for all that I've said, being a consequentialist, recognizing the goods that the laws do, you could actually go exactly Jeremy's way, or you could go a slightly different way. So, for example, the slightly different way might be, for example, to say the laws against torture should be in place, but if someone actually practices torture against a terrorist, say a would-be suspect, then the following is true, that while that person will have broken the law and will be brought to court, Israeli High Court at some pattern like this, or recommended some pattern like this, then a defence might be that there was enormously persuasive evidence available that this person had this information that would save thousands of lives and so on. For all I've said, that might be the way to go. But for example, if you go with Jeremy's arguments in that paper, many of you will know it, he wanted to say, and I think, I just want to make one, as a consequentialist, you could go along, it would depend on the facts of the matter. Jeremy wanted to say that the law against torture is, I think the word used, is archetypal of the sanctity and the utility and the importance of law in itself. That brutality was not exercised by those who ran the law, and that it's so important here that even the emergency type exception should not be allowed, because allowing that exception, so to speak, deprives law, this being such an important instance, this case of torture, that there should be not even presumably the Israeli type arrangement of it being a defence against you're being found guilty of torture, that in fact you had this special evidence available. Okay, so the sort of consequentialism that that is emerging from this, I think, is something I call sometimes standby consequentialism. You know, you periodically you think about, you know, the things you're committed to, the virtues you endorse in yourself, the laws that you regard as sacred, that's really important, the laws that you want to change, of course, too, and that'll be a matter for civic action. And you go on automatic pilot to a certain extent, recognizing that that's the only way of producing these particular goods. But you're on standby alert in the sense that the red lights can go on at any moment, and then you will think. You don't lock yourself out of that possibility. But neither do you, so to speak, indulge that possibility of thinking about the pros and cons so much that you don't produce any robustly demanding goods at all. I just, at the top of the second page, I'm going to have to increase pace now. Just, I want to take 10 minutes more, most. I've mentioned, you know, the traditional objections, meaning the traditional claims that consequentialism is deeply revisionary, and indicating why it need not be, once you recognize the importance of the robustly demanding goods and their place and their impact on thinking about the right. So, for example, traditional objection, the wrong actions objection. If you're a consequentialist, then you're going to say, let's go back to the... it doesn't matter whose example it was. The example of the... a crime has been committed, it's the Wild West, a crowd is gathering, they're really, really hyped up, they're going to do terrible property damage, and there'll be widespread loss of life because they've gone sort of crazy. You're the sheriff. The only way you can do this is by stop this is by scapegoating someone you actually know to be innocent but who's believed by the mob to be responsible, and to have a summary trial and sentencing and perhaps hanging. So the argument used to be that, well, any consequentialist focusing on consequences is bound to support scapegoating, support what is intuitively the wrong action, the wrong option in a choice like that. But now, once you recognize the importance of what law produces, you are the sheriff, in the way of freedom and dignity and respect and so on, you must recognize that you are, though you may stop the riot here and now, what you've done, though, is put in jeopardy a much more constant, you know, longer-running sort of value, which is the value is produced by a law that is known to be a law that is not manipulated by a sheriff in the way in which it would be manipulated in the case of scapegoating. You may, in various cases, decide to breach the law, or decide indeed to breach the demands of virtue, but you're going to be, and therefore to do it might intuitively seem to be the wrong thing, like telling the lie to the world would be murder. Remember, Kant thinks, at least in that particular one particular passage, that you shouldn't tell a lie to the would-be murderer, you should tell the truth. You must, if you do that, at least give reasons that will enable other people to think of you that the virtue really does matter to you, but this was a very special occasion. That's how you justify it, equally with breaking a law. And you recognize, if you go along with with the thoughts I've been pursuing here, you recognize that if you covertly breach the law, for example, as the sheriff in this example might do, then that's a really, really dangerous thing to do for the following reason. To the extent to which it's unlikely that you be found out about your abusing the law, your breaching the law, your, for example, scapegoating someone, to the extent that it's unlikely, it's going to be actually more credible that the law doesn't mean much to you at all. I mean, if it were likely you'd be found out, you'd be unlikely, you'd presumably have a justification to offer. But if it's very unlikely that you'd be found out, and you are discovered, you are found out, and it's clear to everyone you're hiding this, then you've let loose, so to speak, the dogs of uncertainty and diffidence. Now it's no longer clear that there's this law that is truly in place steadfastly to protect all of us. Okay, the wrong reasons objection. So that's the objection that goes, look, if you're a consequentialist, you might sometimes support the right thing to do, but look, you're going to support it in all the wrong way. It'll be F.H. Bradley, I put this at the end of the second page, thinks, for example, if you're a consequentialist, you go in for what he calls incessant practical casuistry. You know, in every case, looking at the pros and the cons, and you're going to end up sometimes doing the right thing, but it'll be for the wrong reason. You'll help the friend because it's for the benefit of the world overall, but that'll be for the wrong reason. It won't be for a reason that enable him or her to think that you're really a friend. Or Bernard Williams's version was that you may end up doing the wrong thing, but you'll have had one thought too many, as he put it very nicely. Now, notice actually on the approach that I've described, call it red lights or standby consequentialism, you won't have one thought too many. When circumstances are normal, when the red lights are not going on, you will be a person of virtue, committed to the virtue, recognizing the good that it does, locked into it, so to speak, on automatic pilot. It's just that you'll be open to the lights that may cause you to breach it, but in those cases, you'll be ready to defend to other people what you've done, explaining to them that this is not a case where the virtue required you to act in what they might have thought to be the way required, and that actually you still are a person of that virtue. So that there won't be one thought too many. You won't be, as you act on automatic pilot under the virtue, you won't be thinking, oh, I'm doing this because this is for the best. No. Or if you're, for example, a friend and you're helping someone, it won't be because you think this is really for the best in the world because I know that the practice of friendship produces all these goods. You won't be thinking at all like that. You'll just have locked on to friendship. I won't talk about the over-demanding objection because I'm running out of time. It'll come up in discussion, and I'm happy to talk about it then if you like. But one question you might ask now, wait a moment, is this a very Rococo image of the human agent you're presenting us with? You know, someone who's locked into these virtues, committed to these laws, more or less an automatic pilot in whole ranges of life, apart from the area where there's discretion allowed, but ready to, when the red lights go on, ready to act. Isn't this a very strange, you know, over-designed, over-engineered sort of picture of human agency? So I just want to say in support of it, actually, it's a picture of human agency that goes with a lot of contemporary cognitive psychology. Think of people like Andy Clark, for example, people who tell us that the really false image of human agency is the Cartesian image, where there's one center, you know, that determines everything, the control center. Now, we know of human agents that we offload control to various modules, in the way in which I offload control to my fingers, you know, in typing. I don't think this is the A, that's and so on. And that's the way it is in human life. In a whole range of cases, think about words coming to you. You know, you just depend on the word production mechanism to operate appropriately, so the words will be available for you to use. And under this image, there are three aspects to it in a way. You offload control to the virtues that are really part of you. You let them speak for you. But on the other hand, you stand by because you don't let them, you're not a slave of those modules. And you will go into action when the red lights go on, and you outsource that control. You don't constantly monitor to see, is this a case where I should be thinking again? You know, you let the situation, you outsource control as to when you should suspend the virtue and think about what is for the best to the situation, depending on the red lights that will come on. So you can lead, actually, a psychology, a psychological life, a mental life that is very like the life we know that human beings lead anyhow, and yet be this sort of standby consequentialist. There isn't any sort of self-engineering that's particularly wild. Now, I've actually spoken for 55 minutes, and this section remaining, I'm inclined to think I should just drop it. You can probably read the argument if you wish. Let me just in 2 minutes say what the argument is. The argument is, or the question raised is, if I'm a consequentialist, there's no problem about doing what I've just described as doing. So there are various choices. There are choices in particular situations about which action to choose, where the values and the laws are silent, and there are choices about which the virtues and the laws are silent. There are choices about which virtues to want to maintain and inculcate and police and bind and so on. And I make these various choices and I let my life run on from there. Now, there's no problem about how, for example, I can evaluate virtues and think about, well, now, what does friendship mean to me? What are the cases where it makes demands? What sorts of demands do they make? How important are those demands? As a consequentialist, of course, I can think about all of that in terms of, well, how important are the goods that they're producing? I mean, I don't want to sound like I'm excessively sort of self-centered moralist, you know, thinks about all of these things. But in principle, that's going to be available as a consequentialist, that you should do that. And equally with the laws. For example, what are the best laws of property? How much public property? Private property? What are the rights that should be given to private property? How far should there be an estate tax, for example? That's all part of... And no problem. As a consequentialist, I can, of course, think about those things. So I use the same criterion as what promotes the good overall with all of these issues. What are the best laws? What are the best virtues? What are the best actions? What's the best pattern in which they might be combined in a human life? But now what it seems to me is non-consequentialists are deeply focused on the choice of action only. And what they're really motivated by, and I understand the motivation, you can see it, I understand it from what I've said, what they're really motivated by is that, above all, we should not think that in the choice of action, the action we choose should be determined just by what's for the best overall in the world. Because that's going to, for example, mean, remember Bernard Williams' argument, that I'm going to have no principles, I'm not going to be a person of integrity, because what I do in any instance is going to be a function of what the circumstances demand, and that's always going to be situational. So I can do the most dreadful things, compensating for the evil that others have done in different circumstances as I pursue the best. I won't have a character, I won't have any virtues, I'll be a cipher, a function of just what circumstances demand of me. And the other, you know, large objection which correlates with that nicely is that, look, if I think always about what's for the best, then surely I will often use other people as means. You know, I'll think of them in a way that, you know, I do this, I do that, but they'll respond and so on, and I think what's the best overall, rather than treating them as agents properly. Rather than giving them respect. That's always been the worry, those sorts of worries. They only exemplify the range of worries, but those two, the integrity worry, the respect worry, have really motivated properly non-consequentialists. See, they motivate me too. That's exactly what we've been talking about, robustly demanding goods, that you've got to lock in dealing with other people. And if you are going to have, you will have integrity if the virtues matter to you. And other people will enjoy respect at your hands once you recognize how important it is that you let the virtues control what you do and let the laws control what you do. So we consequentialists of this camp, can go along with that non-consequentialist worry and say, listen, guy, don't worry that much. You know, of course we're all concerned with this. We all are intent on promoting a pattern of decision-making that will enable us as agents to have this integrity of having principles, being predictable, people knowing where they stand, and being someone, you know who you are, so to speak. And equally, we're going to be concerned about having patterns of behaviour and virtue and law in place that such that other people will enjoy respect, laws that we won't break just on a purely ad hoc basis for a short-term benefit because of recognising the great good that law does and how it's jeopardised utterly to the extent to which I play fast and loose with it. So we can be... look one another in the eye on these issues. So we agree on these issues. But now, when you ask the non-consequentialist, But wait a moment, you tell me we should, say, respect privacy, respect property, respect free speech. Think about all the examples. Respect the demands of friendship. And now I say to the non-consequentialist, oh, by the way, what's the pattern of friendship you think is the one that you should be respecting in dealing with friends? Or what's the property system that you think we should be respecting and respecting the things that other people own? Or what's the privacy, or what's the range of speech, or what's the background sense of speech that we think we should be respecting in acknowledging the right of free speech on the part of others? And it seems to me at that point, I'm just going to make this a confession now, not an argument, that where the non-consequentialist has a ready answer, well, of course, there's the patterns that are for the best. The non-consequentialist, and I include contractualists, and I include John Rawls in this, and Tim Scanlon and the lot, I think are going to have a very hard task of giving an answer that is characteristically non-consequentialist. Because unlike the case where you're choosing an action, there isn't an issue of integrity of the agent or respect for others involved here. You just choose the best laws, but that's consequentialist. Anyhow, that's probably a bit opaque, just as I've stated it. But I hope it's not entirely dark. So it completes what I want to say. And just to remind you of the structure, so we've isolated one category of values, the robustly demanding values, distinguished them into those that are entrenched by virtues in ourselves as agents and those that are entrenched by the norms and laws and attitudes established in the society, and recognizing that they're really important in determining what is right, even on a consequentialist theory of what's right is what produces the goods overall, you get an overall picture that is consequentialist, but not so revisionary of common sense morality as might have been expected. And then the third suggestion is that actually non-consequentialists, they're very good at telling you you should respect what property demands of you, respect what privacy demands of you, respect what friendship demands of you. But I can't see that they're very good at telling us what's the best pattern of friendship? The friendship pattern that you should be abiding by, or the property pattern, or the privacy pattern, or whatever it might be. Okay, so I'll stop there. Thank you very much.